We've heard the headline, probably many times. Man charged with infecting several women with HIV. This story is part of a growing worldwide trend towards criminalizing HIV transmission. This criminalization, along with the corresponding media sensationalism, is raising alarm bells for those working on HIV/AIDS prevention. Joining us to explore the implications of this criminalization of HIV is Michael Vaughan. Michael Vaughan is the policy director of the BC Civil Liberties Association, and she spent several years working with AIDS Vancouver and on the legal and ethical issues relating to HIV and AIDS. Michael joins us on the phone from her home in Vancouver. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
So what's your response when you hear these kinds of headlines about people being charged with the transmission of HIV?
Well, we certainly have had concerns about this for a very long time, we being the BC Civil Liberties Association and various AIDS service organizations throughout the country. It begins in 1999 when we start talking about criminalization issues. And of course, that's not just for the transmission of HIV. In fact, the Supreme Court of Canada case that kicks us off in 99 is about non-disclosure of HIV status, your positive status, to a sexual partner. So in fact, in order to be criminalized, as it were, you don't actually have to transmit HIV. The point is, if you do not disclose to a sexual partner that you're having sexual contact with that could transmit HIV, if you do not disclose, that failure to disclose is considered to nullify their consent to a sexual act. And without consent, what you have is sexual assault. And that's the charge that comes from non-disclosure of HIV. So when I see the headlines, as you ask, what do I think? I think, gosh, you know, we've been in this discussion / battle for coming on to 10 years now about whether this will, one, effectively protect people from HIV. And at the time, the court obviously thought this would be some deterrent to having people not disclose, ergo have people at risk of HIV. But tons of people, including us, said, no, this will be a deterrent to people getting tested, to knowing their status, and to people understanding that it's their job to protect their sexual health. If they're relying on their partner to disclose, that's not a very effective protection. So coming up for 10 years, we've been having this debate, and it doesn't appear that the criminalization has done what presumably the court had hoped it would do, which is act as a deterrent.
So there's no specific law that talks about HIV disclosure. It falls under other charges, like assault or things like that.
Exactly. There's no HIV-specific law in this realm. And because it is, we don't have a statute, for example, that sets out this is what, you know, these are all the details, then we develop the law through the common law. The courts interpret how this law will look when they have new cases that come forward. So one of the obvious cases that has keeps veering up, and yet we don't have a definitive answer quite yet, is whether or not there is such a thing as a safe sex defense to non-disclosure. So if an HIV-positive person is going to engage in safe sex and not disclose, does that put them in criminal jeopardy? And, I mean, it sounds silly. 10 years on, we don't have a definitive answer to that. It does appear that there is probably a safe sex defense, and I say that only because it does appear to be judicial practice. Judges seem to take this into account very significantly in an instruction to the jury, and we've seen that in British Columbia, where they're the judge informed the jury that there was no legal duty on the accused to disclose their status if they had used a condom with all of the complainants, for example. Now, because that really never arose in cases where we get that sort of fact pattern worked into the decision, we don't actually have that as a statement of law. But we've seen this kind of reiterated in courts enough that we would suggest that there probably is at this point a safe sex defense, right? So you go, well, how could the law be this gray and fuzzy? It's even worse than that, because there are medical developments that play into this as well. What we have very recently is we have some European experts saying that individuals who don't have a detectable viral load, so people who are HIV positive, but they're on their meds and their meds are very effective and make the viral load in their bodily fluids, you know, undetectable is the designation of the measure. That's very, very low suppression of the virus in their system. European experts say you can't actually transmit the infection. If that were the case, and that's very often the case with people who are successfully on medication. So how, looking at the court's decision, how can you be posing a significant risk of serious bodily harm, which is the test, by failure to disclose that fact? We don't know what the courts will say, but the scientific evidence is going to weigh in on this as well. So it's really unsurprising that people don't know what the law is, because it's incredibly complicated and hard to get a handle on.
So who's actually being charged under these laws?
Well, if you just look at the headlines, and I can't say that I have done a comprehensive search of court cases that have been brought. The facial appearance of what you see in the newspapers does suggest a highly disproportionate, or presumably disproportionate, number of racialized men and immigrants and gay men are typically who is being charged here.
And so how does that, why is that, do you think?
Well, people have various theories. Now, there's a whole big cultural factor that comes into play here. One is, there probably are a lot more instances of where these charges could be laid, arguably, within the gay community than there are. And we might look to the fact that the gay community did the most, I think you could argue it was the most successful public health campaign in the history of the world by essentially assisting to invent safer sex. The notion of responsibility for your own sexual conduct and health is, you know, still, although arguably fading with each generation, still pretty well grounded in certain segments of the community. The messaging in the 80s, even at the beginning of our awareness of the HIV pandemic, the messaging to heterosexual people in a kind of a public health realm was always totally different than that was generated by the community-based response to AIDS. What public health said to heterosexuals was, know your partner. That was the messaging, as opposed to there are barriers, safer sex, take responsibility for it. Know your partner, which was all about disclosure. And so that messaging has been fairly consistent, as I say. And so maybe it is unsurprising that we see more of these charges in the context of male and female sexual relationships, because that messaging has always, been fairly prominent.
Well, it's interesting because I don't know what the statistics are, but I mean, hundreds of people every year are infected with HIV, but there's only maybe, a dozen charges or convictions each year? What is the sort of proportion?
I don't actually know. I mean, we are still looking at a fairly sizable proportion of people who seroconvert every year. And, you know, if you say, well, you know, we don't have a lot of cases being brought forward, then we're looking at a whole series of question marks as to why that would be. Perhaps people are engaging in sexual conduct, sexual activity with people that who they know their sero status, they know they're positive, in which case the issue of disclosure is moot, one possibility. Two, they don't want to go through the court process, which is arduous for all parties involved and just generally horrible. Three, there's a highly selective prosecution going on. And perhaps, as various people have suggested, the fact that so many of the accused are you know, from racialized minorities and immigrant communities, et cetera, or somehow, you know, minority or marginalized populations, representatives of, perhaps that's not just a fluke. So those are three of the options that I can think of. You can take your mix and match pick. I don't actually know. I suspect it's probably some combination.
So this is all about disclosure. And so that gets into a very kind of complicated social situation, the stigma around HIV and disclosing and power differentials in sexual relationships depending on who feels comfortable disclosing, safety, trust. How do those things impact this whole picture of criminalization?
It's about as tangled a web as you could possibly imagine in terms of exactly all of those things that you've pointed out. Culture and power dynamics and gender and a whole bunch of other things. I remember it was probably the starkest example I've ever seen of trying to visually understand how complex this issue was and why simple messaging and simple homilies were just ridiculous in this kind of sphere. I attended the International AIDS Conference in 96. And there was a poster presentation where they asked a group of young women, I think it was an American-based study, they asked a group of young women why other people didn't practice safe sex. And their answers were, you know, the number one answers, you know, ignorant, lack of education, you know, just stupid or whatever, right? And then they asked, why don't you practice safe sex? The number one answer was, you can probably guess, because I really love him. Not one answer in the top five matched from why do they versus why do you. So it's very, very clear that we're dealing with quite a complicated set of subjective emotional feelings, relationship dynamics, culture, and a whole bunch of other things. It's not a simple equation. And if there's anything that's complicated this as a kind of a key factor, it has got to be the historical stigmatization of HIV. There are you know, other life-threatening STIs, and they don't have anywhere near the kind of weight culturally that HIV continues to have because of an ongoing stigmatization. So there's just no way that cannot factor in.
And there are several sort of principles of sentencing when it comes to criminal law, and one of them is deterrence. But I have to say I'm a bit skeptical about whether, you know, in the heat of the moment, people will think, oh, it's illegal not to say, therefore I will disclose. It seems like there's a lot of other factors at stake in that dynamic. Is there any evidence that makes making the non-disclosure of HIV status illegal actually changes people's behaviors?
No, I don't. I am not aware of any such evidence. And the sort of the battle of the social scientists and the people who, you know, have their gut senses because of where they worked has always been really at play at this. As I say, the grassroots community response and several legal scholars' response was you will merely provide a massive incentive to people not to know their status. And then, as you say, very, very little evidence criminologically that this is part of what's going into the logistical equation of people in their sexual decision making. So I don't know that we have something definitive, but it certainly has been, and it's a very legitimate question. Do we have any evidence whatsoever? Unfortunately, for the court to decide that it's probably a reasonable kind of way to go does not require that sort of evidence.
Another principle of sentencing is rehabilitation. How does this criminalization affect people's sense of responsibility in practicing safer sex, do you think?
Well, you know, it's interesting. If you're actually looking at something other than punishing someone for failure to disclose, if you are actually looking at a broader cultural, what are we doing with HIV in this country, then you are putting an HIV-positive person into a scenario, a.k.a. a prison, in which case, in which situation, the HIV rate of that population will be much higher than the statistical population norm. And the ability to transmit HIV is a high likelihood. In fact, we have a definite transmission of HIV in prisons crisis in most of the world, in part because we have grave difficulty convincing prison officials that having a tattoo program, even to cite the Canadian context here, a recent Canadian context, that we should have sterilized equipment in order to allow inmates to properly tattoo. Because in the absence of those things, what do we get? Shared needles. And of course, that's not the only way that needles are being shared in that context and otherwise. So, you know, it isn't as if we're actually looking at this as a preventative strategy, we've got a really sound epidemiological basis for what we're doing.
Do you think that people will think, okay, well, people will disclose to me, because if they don't, it's illegal, and that might give them a false sort of sense of security and not worry so much about taking measures themselves to practice safer sex?
Well, yeah, it really is. It seems so problematic to say that you're going to predicate your sexual risk assessment on what somebody tells you, because you're assuming a bunch of things, including the fact that they actually know. So much of the science of HIV plays into the transmission. And one of the things that we know is viral load, as I was mentioning, the viral load defense, you have minimal viral load, you can't transmit the virus. Viral load is at peak in a person living with HIV at two stages of their disease. At the very end stages of their disease, they will have very high viral load. And in the first 6 months of their infection, before a test can definitively tell you whether or not you have HIV, your viral load is huge. You haven't developed the antibodies yet to make a battle against the virus on your out of your own immune system. So consequently, various epidemiologists have said that really it's the window period, what we call that, the window period really fuels the epidemic, in which case what you're doing with disclosure is nothing. It's not as if somebody could probably even tell you. And how many people know their HIV status anyhow? People who are positive know their status. Not very many people actually know they're negative. That would mean that they had an HIV test since their last risk activity. I'd suggest that's a very low portion of the population. So, yeah, to actually make that, to make your sexual risk assessment predicated on what other people tell you, it's bad science, it's bad policy.
Why do you think there is this trend towards criminalizing HIV? Where does that come from?
Well, unfortunately, we see all kinds of very unsavory trends with HIV. And I'm going to use another example of an HIV law to illustrate this one, which is the Good Samaritan laws, quote unquote. There are scare quotes around those words. I made them in the air. I know you can't see them. There's the laws that say, and we've got them in a few different provinces, that if an emergency worker, meaning a fireman or an ambulance driver or a police officer, were to provide assistance to somebody in an accident situation, for example, and they were exposed to their bodily fluids, they could get the person that they assisted tested for HIV. Right? That's the Good Samaritan laws to prevent the unknowing of the person who might have been exposed to bodily fluids. These laws are a disaster. I can talk about all kinds of the science as to why these laws are a disaster, but at bottom, we have to ask ourselves the question, geez, what happens if a police officer bleeds into an open wound of mine? Why can't I have him or her tested? And the answer is obvious, because when you're talking about HIV, there's an entire us versus them mentality. People really do honestly believe that there is a them who gets HIV. It's not an us, it's a them, and we need special rules for them. And this kind of binary and othering of people who live with HIV, I think, is so much at the bottom of this kind of logic of, you know, criminalization and punitive measures and trying to address the epidemic in that fashion.
Why criminalize HIV and not other communicable diseases?
Well, you know, HIV is the one that came up in the context of this particular case, and as I say, it has very dire health consequences. Although, you know, the science has mitigated this since the early days of the epidemic, for sure. With other STIs, we seem to be much more comfortable with a public health approach. And the public health approach exists in the context of HIV as well. And so the public health approach is simply, although I shouldn't set it out as being simple, it can be quite complex, is to, one, frame this issue as a health issue and not a criminal justice issue. Two, to allow the health authorities to handle this starting with the least invasive way possible. So that is, partner notification and contact tracing and looking to inform people and urge them for testing and, you know, advise them and assist them in partner notification and those kinds of things. So actively providing some assistance in a public health context. Public health laws do actually get quite draconian. I mean, if you're really pushed to unwilling and unable and doing dastardly things, then, you know, public health has some teeth at the end of the continuum. But at the start of the continuum, it is really an approach that is predicated on assisting and taking a health vantage point on the issue as opposed to a punitive vantage point. So in other scenarios, we seem quite comfortable with this, and as I say, this exists in the HIV scenario. We just had this added layer of the potential of a complainant going to the police to actually lodge a criminal complaint, but you don't have to. If you wanted to, you could actually deal with this whole issue through public health.
How do you think all this media sensationalism affects the whole picture around HIV prevention?
I suppose the word I'm looking for is nightmare, isn't it? I see, for example, and I can't remember when this was it a year ago, a year and a half ago, the Vancouver Police Department publishing a notice warning people that there was a suspected sex trade worker who was not disclosing to her clients that she had HIV. And it happened to be a young Aboriginal woman. And I remember seeing this, the police disclosing this photo and name, and thinking to myself, if there's any retribution against these young women, I would like to see the police sued very, very badly, because this is an outrage. Is a complete outrage. I mean, if you think about the logic of what that ad was saying, is in case you're not absolutely clear on this notion, buying sex does not guarantee that you will be having sexual activity with somebody who is disease-free. Thanks for the news. I mean, it's appalling when you think about this, because presumably, absent a warning, you should be able to assume that. I mean, not only should you not be able to assume that with just anybody, I mean, the logic of this is insane. The underlying theme would be you get to assume that you can have guaranteed safe sex without using a condom. You can buy it or get it for free. However you get it, absent a warning, you're okay. And as I say, I didn't even know where to begin. And these kinds of measures are becoming increasingly common.
And there's the whole issue of the woman's privacy.
This is absent a criminal charge. This is the police undertaking this under what they perceive to be their duty to warn obligations, which I say are highly challengeable and have been the subject of complaint to the Vancouver Police Department.
Do you think that criminal charges are ever justified?
Boy, that's a really hard one. I don't know. I honestly don't follow enough of the individual cases to understand the facts well enough to say, well, you know, I personally. I think that there's obviously a continuum of culpability. I would hate to think, and I couldn't rule out the idea of somebody deliberately trying to infect somebody else, in which case perhaps I would feel that that level of culpability does warrant a criminal sanction. The kinds of cases that I typically see coming up of non-disclosure, I feel for all kinds of reasons, including the broader public health messaging and really caring about what happens to HIV in Canada, should not be criminalized.
Well, thanks so much for joining us and helping us explore and understand this this issue.
Oh, it's been great to be here. Thanks.
We've been speaking with Michael Vaughan. She's the policy director of the BC Civil Liberties Association. And if you want to find more resources about the criminalization of HIV, you can check out the website of the Canadian HIV/AIDS Legal Network. That website is www.aidslaw.ca. That's www.aidslaw.ca.